Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Infamana Knots.
This is show number 5, coming to you after a very, very exciting weekend here in Seattle.
Oh yeah. I can't even explain how pumped up everyone's been over the past week.
It has literally been nuts. So for those of you who do not live in Seattle or do not follow anything in the world of sports, Seattle now is home to... Well, arguably, it's... So the way they phrase it is the first major championship since 1979 when the Supersonics won the NBA Finals. Of course, then people are quick to point out that the Seattle Storm, the WNBA team, has won 2 championships in that time. Mm-hmm. So this is... We'll just say it is now time for the men in the city to catch up with the women's teams, because apparently they're dominating their sports and the men are not.
That's a great way to put it. I like that.
So that's what happened this past weekend. It was extremely exciting. It was really exciting leading up to that point. So this was my first time being in a city with a professional football team and getting to kind of go through and experience all of this stuff. I'm originally from Indiana. I was living in Indiana when the Colts, under the glorious Peyton Manning, one. I'm from Indiana.
Oh, how they fall.
That was a bad... I will always be a Peyton fan. Always. It is like... It's in my blood now. And I remember watching him in the Super Bowl and winning that, and that was amazing. But to be here in this city to watch the Seahawks take it was just really, really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And today I went downtown, and I braved the almost 750,000 people.
An incredible cold.
It was about 25 degrees outside today. And we went down there and stood outside for a very long time and watched the parade go through. And it was a very, very cool experience.
I can't believe 700,000 people stood there in that cold.
700,000 people. The city of Seattle, the population of the city of Seattle is about 627,000 or something like that.
Wow.
So there were more people in the city than... There were more Seahawks fans than there are, you know, residents of Seattle. And they came out. There were people coming from, like, Bellingham. I think I heard that there were people flying in from, like, Vancouver and all this type of
Vancouver.
Stuff.
Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, it was just... it was a very unique experience. I think you can... There's lots of things that you can say about America's sports culture that you can say about the Super Bowl and especially as more scientific, you know, technology types, there's lots that we can say about people being obsessed with sports fans or whatever, or with sports and these kinds of things. But there's nothing that I've seen unite the city like the Seahawks have.
That's true. Yeah. I think we're a city of subcultures. We all have different sub-communities that we're a part of. I mean, you know, obviously, you can be a part of more than one, but everyone's a Seahawks fan.
Everyone is a Seahawks fan. The type of people that you see wearing jerseys are just all across the board.
Right.
It really is surprising. And I know being down there with that many people, I know that the police called in all of their off-duty cops today. If they weren't on leave, they were on the streets. I think some people were really nervous about what it would be because it was so spontaneous, so quickly thrown together. They were afraid that it could be a mess, and it was packed, and it was, you know, chaotic, just as all that kind of stuff is. But there was such a positive spirit in the streets and in the city that it was. People were there. They genuinely loved this team. And everybody was shared together. And so it was not, you know, we're walking around doing stuff and never felt like it was just, I've been in places where you kind of feel the tension and like just the little bit of the uncertainty kind of right under the surface of like a big group. There was nothing like that down there today.
You know, in the Bay Area, if you go to any kind of a Giants game or a Raiders game or a 49ers game or an Oakland A's game, there's definitely tension.
Yeah.
But... You know, I would say that if you go to a Sharks game, and this is one reason I like hockey a lot, maybe it's just because in the Bay Area, it's just one hockey team. You have the Sharks. If you like hockey, you're a Sharks fan, and there's no other fans to contend with. So, yeah, in that same way, the Seahawks are kind of our Sharks. That's the way I like to view it, but I'm sure they'd not like hearing that from me.
Yeah, I don't know how that would, I don't know how that would go over, but anyways, it was really cool and it was really fun, and it's been so fun. One of my favorite things that I've seen is driving down the 5. I think I had to go to the airport or something. Saw the 12 on the Boeing factory. Big, huge flag flying out front.
Yep.
Just on the warehouse there, and that is really cool to see it flying from the Space Needle, and to see all the businesses and the bus drivers with the 12 sticker on the stuff, and even as in the parade, the players were waving the 12 flags and everything, the 12th man. That was just,
yeah, it's a point of pride now.
It really is, and it's extremely cool to see the city come together behind something like that. So go Hawks,
definitely, yeah. Definitely. Actually, I'm going to be doing a poster on Friday, and my advisor, he had me change the colors from my poster from being like this normal black, white, and red color scheme to the Seattle Seahawks team colors.
That's awesome.
And I had to actually do that. He was very insistent, so that happened.
I approve. I approve. All right. Do we have any follow-up that we want to get to from the last show or anything that else has come up?
Well, let's not forget that coffee script metaphor, which
you finally got it?
No, I don't. Not yet. I'm still procrastinating a bit. I'll get around to it eventually. This is going to be like the thing that I never do.
Yeah.
That metaphor.
We're just going to keep bringing it up over and over and over again.
Yep, yep. I mean, one day I'll get just so annoyed with it, I might actually do it. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? You mentioned that you... There was a YouTube video.
Yeah,
that you got.
So I was down. Every now and then I'll download YouTube videos. If I want to watch them at some point, but don't want to leave the browser window open, I'll use the YouTube downloader little program, Python script to download it. And I was pulling one down today. It was a long science talk, and it came down. It averaged about 18 megabytes a second. On the UW wireless network.
So it just took seconds to download that?
It was a gigabyte and a half, and it came down in just over a minute.
You're not going to believe me, but over in Mary Gates Hall, I could swear I get 50 megabytes per second when I download stuff. And I think, and that's the Wi-Fi. And if you actually plug into the wall, you can get twice that. It's ridiculously fast, and I don't know why we don't have that same speed like in the medical center, but
yeah, or why we don't. Yeah, this was over in the medical center, but or I mean, this is light years. I mean, this is so far beyond anything I've ever had in my home that you just sit there and you're just kind of like, you just feel the power. Like you can feel it coursing through your laptop, right? Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, at home I have a 40 megabit connection at home, and I get I rarely get it if I do a single download, but if I pull something down or like BitTorrent or whatever, I'll get about six, just under six down. And here we're talking, you know, three times that with a single file over Wi-Fi.
Yep, that's definitely amazing.
Just, oh my gosh, I just, you know, kudos. Kudos to the network engineers at UW. Kudos to Google for putting their data centers, you know, putting their edge nodes right where we can get at them. And
mm-hmm.
So that was very fun. So I thought that was worth popping out. So if you're ever on the UW Medical Center and you want to download this podcast, know that it will come down very, very, very quickly. So it always has a potential to.
Cool.
All right. Well, we should talk about other things that are new and exciting. The big dog in the city, good old Microsoft,
uh-huh.
has a new CEO. Yep. Not very exciting.
Yeah, the boys over in Redmond, I mean, they ended up... I mean, that was like out of left field. I was expecting, you know, the guy from Nokia?
Yeah, Elop?
Yeah, that guy. That's who I was expecting to be chosen as CEO, but...
Yeah, and there was the rumor of that Ford guy, mm-hmm. Alan Mulally or whatever his name is.
Right, but, right.
Satya Nadella, is that how you pronounce it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure I can pronounce it myself, but...
Yeah, Satya Nadella, he is... So he was the VP in charge of the cloud and enterprise.
So they hired from the inside.
They hired from the inside. This guy has been at the company for 22 years, worked closely with Gates and Ballmer and all these kind of guys. And I think that has the potential to be a really good move for a couple of reasons. One, their server and their cloud solutions are actually quite good. Windows Azure has a lot going for it. And their enterprise software has always been pretty top-notch. They've got a really good set there. They've got really good integration going. Like that division has historically been really profitable, really high growth, and done a really good job with adding features and expanding and all these kinds of things. And then the second thing is that they brought in a guy from the inside, somebody who is born and bred in the Microsoft culture. And there are lots of things that you can say about that culture that, you know, good and bad, but the fact is the culture is what made Microsoft Microsoft. And so continuing on that thread, I think, has a potential to be a really good thing to really go back to and restore what made Microsoft a great company in the 90s. And they kind of lost their way and gotten a little bit confused. And I think if they can reassert that culture and bring a new focus on their products and tools, that I think they'll be in a really good spot going forward.
Mm-hmm. I saw the video. They actually had this page up with Mr. Nadella's bio, and I watched the video, and there was some kind of an interviewer just walking with him through the campus and talking about where he's from, what his views are, where he wants to take the company, and all of that. And it sounded very rosy and romantic, I have to say. But that's a good thing. I think that that they need that, because you kind of, it's very Apple-esque, I would say. Like, the way he was explaining things was very Steve Jobs-like. And I don't know, dare I say, he might sort of fill that void. If he can innovate. I don't know if, I mean, I think it sounds like his plan is to enable people to be creative, and they kind of do the exact same thing that Jobs was doing over at Apple, sort of being part of meeting committees and really helping things be designed well. But I don't know if that's going to actually pan out. We're going to have to just wait and see.
Yeah, Microsoft's a big company. It's a big ship to try and turn and get reoriented. So he's definitely got a lot of work cut out for him. But what always blows me away is, I know some people at Microsoft. I think it's hard to be in a sales, it's hard to escape what they're doing. Being in the tech world, you just see it, all around. And it always has felt like they would always present something that had the potential to be really, really cool, and then failed, in a lot of ways, failed to really execute on it.
Oh man, I have a story about that. There was, we had a graduate here, mm-hmm. At a Dub Talk, and she went to Microsoft, and she helped design the whole user interface, and of Windows 8,
wow.
On the tablets. And then she came back and did a talk, and the entire talk, it was just her trying to debug, or not debug, but get the thing to work. Like, she just was not able to give her presentation because it just was not working well. And everyone was just, like, disappointed and shaking their head. Like, I can't believe this is, why is this happening right now? Like, I mean, this is out there in the market, and people can't use it.
Yeah.
So it was a very different, unexpected experience that we had.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I haven't spent a lot of time with Windows 8. A little bit. I don't find it to be so bothersome, but people that I know that use it pretty regularly are not super enthused with it. But I think that there's just a lot. Windows Phone is another example. I think the Windows Phone OS is the best mobile OS on the market. But it's not gaining traction. There's a lot of things that need to be improved and fixed on it. The concept is great, but it's less great in execution. And I find that to be pretty common with Microsoft's packages.
I'm glad to hear that they're getting rid of the whole employee evaluation technique they used to have. I think it's what they adopted from GE, where they basically force managers to get rid of their bottom 10% of workers. So somebody has to get the boot.
Yeah.
And I think now employees are going to be a lot healthier, mentally at least, while working there. So that is definitely a plus.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of good changes coming on the pipe for the Microsoft culture. Again, just kind of being ancillary, being associated with it in kind of an ancillary perspective. I think there's a lot of good things that are coming down the pipe. And I think at the very least, it's going to be really good to see Microsoft kind of back in the saddle or whatever to start pushing. Because they definitely, for whatever you think about Windows 8, Windows Phone, they have a... There is somewhere a unified vision, and it is distinctly different than what a lot of other companies are presenting. And so I think that is, whether you like it or not, whether it succeeds or not, I think it's good for the market and the industry to to have this other option, mm-hmm. and to have the big player in the PC space, in the player with the dominant market share, have a vision that says this is what we're going to do and we're going to go for it. And I would love to see them get it so that the people's issues are, well, I don't like Windows 8, kind of like how they say I don't like OS 10, right? It's right now it's, well, I could like it, maybe I do, maybe I don't, but it isn't executed properly. Right. I would love to see them get to the place where the vision is clear and solid, and then people can pick or choose based on that. So, but you know, it's, we'll see. This is a good signaling, good change. Gates is back as a founder and technical advisor now.
As an advisor.
Yeah.
So it seems like he's ramping down his workload at Microsoft.
Oh yeah, he's too busy with malaria.
Well, at least someone's doing something about that. That's true. Microsoft does do one thing right, I will admit their Windows Phone is gorgeous and so much fun to use.
It really is. I think it's the best OS on the market. The hardware has always been, some of the Nokia stuff, the Lumia 920 is a solid piece of hardware, really great. A little bit big, but it's actually not as big as people made it out to be. And solid performer, great camera, all this good stuff. You know, the issue is, of course, that there aren't a lot of apps for it. They're the core apps, but a couple of them are actually written and developed by Microsoft, which does not bode well for the health and the future of the ecosystem. Yeah. I just don't see them attracting, even if they have the big players, I don't see them attracting the number of small innovators and small players that Android and iOS are attracting. And you can say, well, you know, most of those apps are all really terrible and whatever, which is, you know, true. But there are also some really solid ones that come along that just aren't going to be available on Windows Phone. And I haven't seen that shift recently, which makes me think that Microsoft just hasn't really been able to gather the developer support.
Well, I think it's a matter of market share. I mean, if I was going to be an indie developer, and I the first thing I would want to do is stay afloat. I mean, that is definitely a concern. And the iPhone definitely has a huge market share. Android also has a big market share. Although with Android apps, the customer would expect apps to be free a lot of the time. And you would have to make money through volume, like with advertisements. Whereas with the iPhone, you can actually sell an app for $1, $2, whatever you think your app is worth. With the Windows Phone, I just don't think the market is big enough. Even if I was going to make an app and put it up there on the store, and it sold a few hundred thousand copies, would that be enough to keep me afloat? That is the question.
Yeah.
So I think that's why most developers stray away from Windows development. I've heard a rumor that they even pay students, and they actually pay developers to make apps for them right now.
I've heard that. I know what they used to do was they would give the developer licenses for free. So you would, as a student, be able to get the tools and the license, and the license had the monetary rights attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could create an app and make money off of it. And I'm not sure if they're still, I haven't looked, I don't know if they're still doing that or not, but It's interesting. So I've got a couple projects coming up. One in particular coming up that I'm really interested to. What's interesting to me is the big 45 megapixel camera on the Lumia, the 1020s and the 1025s. I've got a project or two coming up that I think could really benefit from utilizing that technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really interested. So I think I'll have a chance here in the next couple months to kind of dig into the phone development a little bit and get a sense for how it works and how it runs. And I'm interested to run it on iOS and specifically on Windows Phone with iOS, which has a solid camera but really interesting hardware architecture to do a lot of processing and utilizing their like OpenCL implementations, and then for Windows Phone to operate with that massive camera.
You know, I think you've heard of PhoneGap, haven't you?
PhoneGap. Is that the cross-platform development?
Basically, cool. Yeah. So I think a lot of people should move away from native apps if they can and just go towards making web apps with JavaScript. Again, back to JavaScript and CoffeeScript. Basically, if you can make an app that's written in that using that technology platform, then you won't need to worry about having a native app, because that same app is going to open up the same way on a Windows phone, on an iPhone, and on an Android. And on a tablet or on the computer, it's going to work. It's just going to work. And actually, speaking of which, I started to play with Ember.js. Have you heard of Ember?
Yeah, we were talking about that. What? Give me a little bit more details on it, though.
It's basically a model view controller framework
mm-hmm.
that is written completely in JavaScript mm-hmm. and implemented in JavaScript. So what you would typically do with Ruby on Rails, you can do with Ember.js. And it's kind of a different paradigm, and it was a little alien at first. But if I kind of think back to, if I put on my web dev hat, which is the first thing I learned was HTML
mm-hmm.
and JavaScript, it makes a lot more sense. If I look at it from the angle of Ruby on Rails, if I wear my Ruby on Rails hat and then go back to Ember, it doesn't make quite as much sense. So I kind of had to assume the mindset of a beginner.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, it made a ton of sense. And Ember.js, I mean, it's kind of quirky in that you basically make one page. You make one web page, and you use handlebars.js, which
yep.
is a library that allows
mm-hmm.
you to be a little dynamic in your in the content that you actually show. And it's one big HTML file, and it's so dynamic and easy to use. You can actually, instead of having a bunch of routes, the routes are all in one file. So you have one app.js file, and then you have your one HTML file, and that's your entire app. That's it, just two files.
Now, does that run on Node, or is that separate?
Right now it's separate. Like the way I'm running it, I have this little sandbox on my machine right now, and it definitely is separate. It doesn't actually need Node or any kind of server to run. It just runs in and of itself.
Interesting.
So what it basically downloads to the client, and it's all client side. So if you're going to pull up my web page, and it was written in Ember.js, it would download to your computer, and then because it downloaded to your computer, it would be very, very fast on your computer,
yeah.
And it would end up looking like it's very responsive.
Now, why would you choose Ember over like Angular or Backbone, which are other MVC frameworks?
I am not familiar with Backbone, so I can't speak to that. But Angular, I wouldn't say I would choose Ember over it. I would let Ember work with it.
Okay.
I would complement the two.
Okay.
Angular is pretty awesome. In fact,
yeah.
I was talking to my friend yesterday about how his company uses Angular, and how they were able to launch a nice big app in just a matter of 3 months.
So. Yeah, I've been using Angular a bit, learning my way around it, and I definitely like it. I think it's great. So, interesting. Ember, I'll have to look into that a little bit more. I think I've poked around with it and then kind of, walked away from it. But
yeah, it's part of the mean stack. Remember that mean
mm-hmm.
stack? The Mongo, Ember, Angular, and what was the last? The N, Node.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, so it would be an Express. So the mean stack, that the one that I heard is Mongo Express Angular. So it would be so Ember.js, so you're saying, would be a replacement for Express?
I guess it might be somewhere between Angular and Express.
Okay.
I don't think it would replace any of them.
Okay.
But it's a midway point.
Okay.
So maybe we can go Mongo, Ember,
yeah.
Node. The men stack.
The men stack. Easy there, buddy. Easy there.
Oh, man. Very good.
All right. Well, speaking of coding, we have talked in the past about software review in science. So scientific papers and stuff. So they'll publish their results, they'll publish their data, right? And then we want to be able to do reproducibility and work with the code and try it, run our own machines, maybe try our own data, see what kind of results we get. And so a lot of times it's really difficult to look at either code's not published, or it's really odd, or it's hard to read. So Pilos and Mozilla teamed up to do a kind of a pilot study at looking at reviewing scientific code.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did it with a couple with the Open University in the Netherlands, and then with the Mozilla Foundation. And so what they did was they took 11 developers, or they took, I think 11 developers, and took code from some scientists that had to work on, and then they gave them, basically over 18 months, they worked on reviewing the code, looking for, they looked for things like logical errors or data structures or layout or stuff like that, and came and gave feedback and were able to kind of critique the code and help them develop stuff that'd be more transportable and more applicable to cross domains and things. So what was interesting was that they weren't able to run the code themselves because it either required a really complicated stack or needed data or something like that. So they were literally just looking at the code and reviewing it and kind of mapping out what it did. So what they said was the reviewers felt their reviews were really shallow because they couldn't run the code or they didn't have enough domain knowledge to really dig into it too much. But the scientists thought that the reviews were extremely helpful and really appreciated and enjoyed the process. And I think it probably generated all the things that you could think about of taking programmers and dropping them into, you know, kind of parachuting them into these scientific communities and having them look at code and some of the limitations on that. But the scientists thought that it was really a big step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And what they didn't say was whether that had an impact on repeatability or transportability. Simply, this is a result of some pilot studies. So I think we're going to get more data down the line. This paper was published on the preprint sites, so it hasn't been peer reviewed or anything. But I think it's an interesting concept and one that could really have some potential going down the road.
Yeah, definitely. I think it kind of makes sense to me that scientists would enjoy this because, in terms of focus, I think a scientist is more focused on the science and less on the coding. I mean, we code because we have to code, not because we, you know, choose to code all the time. So in that sense, I could definitely see that, you know, we would sort of be sloppy every now and then, or we would just code a certain use case and not let the code or not intend for the code to be robust. And if someone wanted to pull that down and, you know, take what we did and tweak it, that could be an issue for them. Especially if it's like hairball spaghetti code,
right? Yeah.
So if we do have a coder around who helps you sort of organize your stuff into classes and ontologies as you build them, as you build your code and you build your app, then that may be scalable for the future and it may be usable. And yeah. I think that might be the key point here is that as a scientist, when we write code, we do it just to get the job done a lot of the time. But maybe we should write it so that way it's usable by other scientists. Isn't that like a way, like sort of a surrogate for reproducibility? I mean, if I wrote a computer program right now and it did the job that it needed to do, but you pulled it down and you couldn't write on top of it, wouldn't that not have met the criteria of being reproducible?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. And I think that's the things that they're concerned about. One of the things they talked about was that the scientists cared a lot about the quality of the code, but you're right, their focus wasn't on the code itself, it was on the science. And so while they cared about it, there was limits to what they were either able to do from time or expertise or, mm-hmm. or whatever. But they were really interested in having somebody else come along and like take a look at it. So the programmers that they brought in had done code reviews in the past. They kind of knew the process. So it wasn't just grabbing programmers and like, do a code review of this. Like, I don't know how to do that anyways. They found what people whose job was to develop code defined to fit different situations and things, or were familiar with the process of how you look at somebody else's code and figure it out. What I think that this could be really interesting is if this code review was included as part of a peer review
process, right?
And could you find, so a lot of labs will have research scientists whose job is to write, you know, to write and develop this type of the code for this type of industry or that discipline. And so could you bring them on the review board where their job is to approve, is to look at the code and kind of approve it and deal with those issues of reproducibility and things like that. Whereas they may not be a scientist, but they have domain knowledge because they work in this day in and day out. They may be familiar with the algorithms and the packages that get loaded in or the different libraries that they might use and might have the ability to include that as part of the review process. I think that could be a really good step in a direction towards making sure that code meets the criteria of science, because that's what it's becoming. So much of science is becoming computational and
collaborative.
And collaborative, that you need to be able to do stuff like this. And program and systems like GitHub are a huge step in the right direction. I think what we see a lot is once the paper's published, the code goes online. And so those two, while they may come somewhat simultaneously, they're not inherently linked together. So it could be that the code doesn't work or whatever. So I think including that as part of the actual review for publication could be a really good thing.
One of the issues I immediately see with that is that certain areas of science don't lend themselves well to computer code.
Yeah.
A good example is, or even GitHub, a good example is synthetic biology. Whenever we make our own organisms, with GitHub, we're looking at changes in text. And a change in text we represent DNA or RNA or proteins as text, but it's really hard to actually combine all of them into a model and then have that model be reflected in GitHub, like the changes to the model.
Yeah.
So it's very text-based, and it's not robust enough to capture all the things that need to be done in that field specifically. Now, I would imagine that there are other fields of science that are in a similar vein that also have similar issues. But I think one thing that came to mind, and this might be kind of, I'm going in a different direction here. Here at the U, we basically have a biostats consulting service for free.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a student and you're working on a paper and you are unsure about your statistics, you can actually make an appointment with a number of other graduate students in the biostats school and the professor, of course. And they'll look at your situation and what you're trying to do, and they'll basically advise you as to, okay, you're thinking about running this test, but maybe in your design you want to be running this different test. And the reason why is because of the way you explained your scientific question and your goals. It seems like it's more apt to solve your problem. And I think that kind of a service should be available maybe for code, for scientific code. Like, okay, I want to build this app, and I want it to eventually be scalable in this way. I want it to eventually have this capability of being a web app or being a command line app. How should I start writing my code? What kind of classes do I need? What kind of structure? Should I have a database, or is a SQLite database good enough for now? Like, that kind of a consultation service might be immensely useful.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think what was exciting to me to look at this was that they did the collaboration with the Mozilla Foundation, which funded a lot of this kind of stuff. And I think that's really cool to see nonprofits and the open source community kind of coming along and saying, we value this, we think this is important, and we want to support this type of work. And I would really like to see some sort of the foundations coming together and saying, yeah, this is an important part of science. This is the thing that we think should be available and included. So we're going to fund we're going to fund some fellowships or scholarships to compensate people for their time in doing this. People who sit on review boards, are compensated in a variety of fashions, either through peer recognition or exposure to the community, something like that. And so if we could add that for code review, that could be another method to accomplish that as well.
Definitely. Most definitely.
Now, you've been looking at some other issues of repeatability, haven't you?
I've been, I found a pretty cool paper, I would say. Actually, I can pull it up right now. I have my computer right in front of me. It's a paper on the most common statistical errors that you'll find in biomedical research.
Interesting.
And they listed about 10 to 20 of them. Let me see if I can pull those up. And just as a gist, let me just cover the first five here, so that way you have an idea of what I'm talking about. The first error is reporting measurements with unnecessary precision. The second one was dividing continuous data into ordinal categories without explaining why or how. The third one was reporting group means for paired data without reporting within pair changes. The fourth one is using descriptive statistics incorrectly. The fifth was using the standard error of the mean as a descriptive statistic, or as a measure of precision for an estimate. So these are basically a list of the most commonly found stats errors in biomedical research papers. And those were just the first five. I'm not going to read all 20 of them to you. because that's just going to be boring.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something, it's a great guideline for us to use to kind of, if you are going through a paper and you aren't sure about what you're looking at, you can use this as like a checklist and kind of go off one by one and go, okay, does this paper have this error? No. Does it have this other error? No. And in that way, know what to look for with a new biostats paper when it comes out. Sorry, BMI paper, not biostats.
Yeah. That's interesting. What's interesting to me is you read the list off. A lot of those are, I think there's a perception in the general populace that science has this huge problem of falsifying data,
mm-hmm.
of falsifying information. And it's interesting. I've been, over the last day or two, I've been reading some articles on Stephen Glass, the guy who worked for the New Republic, and fabricated a bunch of stories. And then the other one that came up, Jason Blair, I think it is, where they basically fabricated wholesale a lot of their articles and their reports. And so I think that I've had people in the general public come up to me and be like, oh, well, isn't it that they are that people are just making up data and stuff? And, you know, I try to say, no, it's not really that. It's a lot more errors of omission, of things get left out or reported wrong or something like that, as opposed to them going and like fudging the data. Mm-hmm. So would you say this paper bears that out, or do you think it argues with that assumption?
I think it kind of, that's a good question. I think it's kind of calling people out on the way they currently do things, and it's asking them to do things better. And by tightening up the statistics and being a little more critical about what we report and why and how, the idea is that we can basically minimize some of those errors that we're having. And like, here's number 18. I didn't read 18 yet. Not distinguishing between pragmatic, which is basically effectiveness, and exploratory, or explanatory, sorry, which is basically efficacy studies when designing and interpreting biomedical research. Or number 19, not reporting results in clinically useful units. Like, it seems like, I mean, there is this interest of professors and of institutions to get things published. And if you're a pharma company, you don't want to publish bad results.
Yep.
And if you're the FDA, you have to be aware of people trying to game the system and doing tons and tons and tons of studies to find some kind of statistical significance for their new drug. Or it's like all these interests come together and make this big hairball of a problem. And I'm not surprised that we find a lot of times, I don't think scientists will make a big lie or a big claim, but they'll make a ton of small ones. You know, a number of, they'll try and get this little thing by you where they won't report the results in a clinically useful unit or, you know, a different error. And it'll kind of compound on itself over time. And that is definitely bad because, if you imagine a multiplicative model, like imagine a golf swing, you know, if your putter or your let's say your 9-iron, if it's just a little bit, you know, maybe 2 degrees off, you know, if 100 yards down the line, it's going to be going in a completely different direction than if you had angled it 2 degrees the other way. So it's kind of that kind of a model is what I'm thinking.
Interesting. No, that definitely makes sense. That's a cool bit. So how will you apply this proactively in your research? So you mentioned knowing what to look for when you see a new biomedical paper coming out, but what about the way that you approach your science and the way that you do your work?
Well, I'm really anal about my statistics. I think every stats professor I've talked to here really calls me out all the time on okay, wait a second. If you're going to do something this way, you might want to be clear on your question. You might want to collect your data in this way, because you can't just do something like collect data and then fish through your results and call it a statistically significant result, especially if you weren't looking for it. If you make your hypothesis based off of what you see now, you have to collect data again and do an independent study. Otherwise, it's not going to count. And they really help me get an idea of what correct and incorrect statistical practices are. So in that way, you know, and using this, you know, articles like this, I think we can, at least I can, hone in on the most common errors that happen and protect myself from making a flub like that.
Good. No, that again, great ideas, great thoughts. One other thing, I always like to try, and when people are talking about things that they're seeing or whatever, ask, how does that apply? How do you apply this in your research? How do you apply this in your work? And I think that, yeah, you answered that. I think it's good to process things, to personalize them, and to try and modify and update our workflows and things like that.
So absolutely.
The thought of the one that you mentioned right at the end was failing to report things in clinically useful units.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna think about that for a little bit, but it seems to also expand to presenting your results in ways that are useful to people.
Yep.
And I think that's sometimes difficult because it's easy just to report the data and say, people can infer and come up with whatever they want. But then that asks, what is the purpose of your research? Is your research just to simply answer a question, or is it to improve upon people's lives or make medicine better or to help, increase efficiencies or things like that? And that's different for different people and different papers. But that asking, how do you kind of take that next step into presenting it in a way that's useful to people? I think it's an important question, but it's a difficult one to answer.
Definitely.
So let's talk a little bit more about research. When you are doing your work, are you a music or no music person?
It depends. If I am in a completely quiet area, then I'm a no music person. If I am in a coffee shop, I'm a no music person. If I'm at home and at night and working on something, you know what? I think what it depends on is not the environment, but really the thing I'm working on. If it's something that takes a lot of concentration, I don't use music. But if it's something that is kind of more busy work, I will definitely use music. How about you?
Yeah, about basically the same kind of thing. Even if I'm doing work, if I'm listening to music, it's music with no lyrics. It's laid back, it's instrumental stuff, it's maybe some classical or something like that. I get my mind wanders too much if I listen to stuff that has too much of either it's too upbeat or has too much other complexity going on to it. This isn't just a silly little question. This is really important on the way that you everyone's workflow is different, and so it's mm-hmm. important to know how music and environments affect the way that we work.
You know, I use a lot of, this is going to sound silly, but whenever I walk, like around the city, like from let's just say the SLU medical building down to a restaurant in South Lake Union or downtown, I listen to rap, a lot of rap. If I listen to, or if I'm going to be doing something like coding, it's going to be a lot more punk music, because for some reason it's a familiar sound to me. I grew up listening to lots of punk.
Yes, you did.
So yeah, that's familiar to me. If I'm going to be rock climbing, I listen to something like classical or more. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
That is really interesting.
Because I'm concentrated.
Most people get the pump-up music when they're like at the gym or doing something,
Yeah, at the gym it's just more pop music, like, the radio.
Yeah.
If it's Miley Cyrus, then it's Miley Cyrus. I just don't care,
Yeah.
Lifting is lifting. And, it's kind of those kind of situations. Definitely at night at home when I'm kind of like winding down, I have an indie playlist. So
definitely.
Definitely. I think it's based more on moods is what I do. Actually, that kind of gets to like the next topic here. I found a pretty cool website called Songza.
Yeah.
And what they do is they basically have music professionals curate music lists, and based on the day and the activity and the time of day, they will recommend a music list to you, and people can, upload it or download it. But either way, they give you a list of songs that you play that help put you in that mood, or help you know it's the evening, or help you know it's work time in the afternoon, or cooking time, or makeout time, or whatever.
You gotta have that makeout time.
Oh yeah.
No, I've heard of Songza, but I have never actually like sat down and really gotten into it very much. But the curated playlist. I have different playlists that change based on mood and stuff like that. I tend to move more towards albums
mm-hmm.
as opposed to playlists of associated songs. So I'll pick an artist and kind of move through their collection or pick an album or something like that and try and play it all the way through. I do have some singles, but not a lot. I wanted to jump in real briefly about your comment on when you're walking listening to rap music. When I am commuting on the bus or something like that, a lot of times I listen to, you know, crappy pop music or something like that. And part of the reason I tell myself I do that is not because, partially just to like check my mind out and just be numbed or whatever, but I think it's also a survival instinct. Mm-hmm. So I think that if I was ever, you know, hit by a bus or, you know, fell, tripped or something like that, or hit by a car or whatever, that my body would refuse to die listening to crappy pop music. So I think it's about ensuring my survival, right? It's the deep down in my soul would just be like, no.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to go with Miley Cyrus being the last thing that I hear. So, so I try and do that. How do you find new music that you want to listen to? Any other tricks or?
Spotify, usually. I use Spotify a lot. Songs is something else I use. The Hype Machine. Have you ever heard of the Hype Machine?
Yeah.
I don't use the Hype Machine very often, but I know people who do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Hype Machine is basically more meant for people who like EDM type stuff.
Yeah.
I like EDM, but I'm much more of an indie person. I think I'm more mellow guitar sound like.
Yeah, so, definitely.
That's just me though.
Yeah, I'm a similar musical taste. I used to use it more. I used to listen to Last FM.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a whole lot of people that still use Last FM, but I'm still on there. Partially, I Scrabble or record everything that I listen to either on my tablet or Spotify or on iTunes on my computer. And it catalogs all that stuff for me. So I can actually see what I've been listening to, my top artists are, top songs. And I kind of keep track over the last couple weeks and months. And they actually had a cool visualization where you could put in your user ID and it would basically build one of those like stacked graphs of like your musical tastes over time. And I really wanted to go back and I would probably do this at some point and correlate my to-do list and my calendar with those and like mark like major events and stuff.
That would definitely be interesting.
Yeah, to see like if I have a bunch of reading coming up, how does my music shift change? Or if I have a day full of meetings, or if I'm traveling, or something like that.
Or can you predict what Nick is doing based on the music he's listening to?
That would be really interesting as well. So I have a meaning to do that. I haven't gotten around to it, but I think that'd be something really fun to do. The other way that I get a lot of music is through KEXP. Do you listen to KEXP?
I do listen to the radio every now and then, but I haven't been listening to KEXP recently. Their office is just down the street from us, by the way.
It is. It's moving, though.
Oh,
they're moving to build a new building right in Seattle Center. But yeah, they're right on Dexter. They're actually, you know, they're partially owned by the University of Washington.
Partially?
Yeah. They're kind of their independent thing, but they are, a service of the University of Washington. So they started as like a student radio thing and now are kind of out on their own.
Did not know that. Wow.
Yeah. So actually, sometimes I'll be listening to something like on my tablet, which is where I have all my music, and I'll be walking by there and I'll hear the ding as it connected to the UW wireless and pull my, So that's kind of what affiliate is like, oh, wait, that's Washington. So kind of funny. But yeah, KXP is a great place. They have their song of the day. It's like a podcast that they download the song and or they will have it that they put up there, and that's a really great way to get new music. So I start my day with KEXP. It's what I wake up to. It's my alarm, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, I really like. It's such a great service. It's an excellent radio station. Great people. They do a lot for the community. Like it's really a cool thing to, and you can hear them. You can either hear it 90.3 here in Seattle or online at streaming online at KEXP.org.
Uh huh.
So, but yeah, that's a great way to do it. And then, of course, friends, right? Friends always have new music that I try and steal. And mm-hmm. Now that I have friends that are kind of spread out across the U.S., I like when they go, I like to see, okay, what are you listening to? What's really popular in your area? And so I picked up a new band recently called Trampled by Turtles.
Never heard of them.
Yeah, they're out of I think my friends in Minneapolis listen to them. I think they're like regional.
By Turtles.
Yeah, and they're quite good. So,
okay, I'm gonna write that down myself.
Yeah.
I've been listening to a lot of Dirty Projectors.
Oh yeah,
I'm sure you've heard of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Good band.
Isn't he like a professor of music at like Yale or something like that?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I thought maybe I'm thinking of somebody different, but he's like a musicologist or something like
that. You'd be surprised at how much I like don't look into bands I listen to. Like I know a lot of people like end up liking a band and then looking them up on Wikipedia and then like going down this rabbit hole of detail and facts and stories. But I don't know, never really been that person.
Yeah. This may be thinking of somebody different, but yeah, they're
pretty good. Maybe
no, James Franco. So I can handle huge chunks of Dirty Projectors, but in certain amounts, I think they're really really awesome.
There's a really cool tool and this is not a tool to discover music, but it's a tool to visualize music. You basically it's on a website called visual.ly.
Oh, you remember when everything was named like I, like mm-hmm. everything had the I in front of it. Now everything's got the Li at the end of it.
Yep, Bitly and all those
other. Feedly.
Yep.
But this thing visually?
Yep. But this thing is called Hook Theory. And it's in beta. Hook Theory. H-O-O-K Theory. And what you do is you basically it's an analysis tool, a music analysis tool, which will analyze songs for you. So if you pick this tool right here, I pulled it up right now, I'm viewing it. It basically has a circle of different notes. C, B minor, A minor, G, F sharp, D, and these are basically just notes in the key of G. And if I click one of them, let's say I click C, it brings up sort of a diagram. It shows me, okay, C, a lot of songs that you have in your library start with the chord C. A percentage of them, 36% go to G, and 27% go to D next, and 9% go to E minor next, and 5% go to G or B. So if I click G, then it'll say, okay, well, 49% of your songs in your library go from C to G to D, and 19% of the songs in your library go from C to G to C. And, you know, you can click on a song and it'll tell you what kind of progression it has. And I would tell you more, but my computer's freezing right now. So, but it's a pretty cool tool to analyze your own library and That's figure out what your musical tastes are like.
Now,
what chords you like.
How does it get access to your library?
I think you just upload. You upload exactly what you have in your stuff. I think you have to sort of export your data as like a text file or something.
Or give it like the iTunes XML or something and it does the...
Yeah, and it sucks it in.
That's interesting.
But it's a pretty cool tool.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I haven't really explored it myself, but it's kind of fun to know stuff.
Yeah, you know, I can't remember why, but visually just came up in another conversation or another article that I was reading, so it seems like an interesting product. But
visually is actually a web aggregator of a bunch of visual content.
Cool.
I haven't used too much of it myself, but definitely it's full of infographics and fun visual tools. And yeah, I mean, I found it during my research for sort of a lit review search for other visualization tools for my research. So yeah, kind of a cool find.
Yeah, that's really awesome. So speaking of websites, we both have our own websites. And you can, you know, if you are listening to the podcast, you should definitely go check out our sites. Some of them are cooler than others, but so how do you, this came up in just as I was trying to, I was thinking about where, you know, different technologies and stuff. Nikhil, how do you host your website?
I keep mine really simple. I go with Bluehost as my hosting service.
Okay.
And then I just have a simple WordPress install, and that's it.
Okay. Now, is Bluehost a, like, give you a blank machine, or is it kind of like
it's shared
hosting. Okay. It's like, I guess it would be what platform as a service gives you a, so you could connect, you say, I want an Apache server, or I want a WordPress, or...
Actually, I bought space on a shared server, like a certain number of megabytes, and then I have a set number of like a bandwidth, and then like on their cPanel they just have a quick WordPress install. So
okay. Yeah.
I just pressed the button and said go, and it did everything for me. So I have no idea. I bet you it is running Apache, but I have no idea if it actually is.
Okay. But yeah, so you're basically, so you're running it as like, you know, software as a service, right? Yes. Deploying WordPress or something like that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, which is what we, for the Informatonauts blog, of course, WordPress does it for free for us. So,
mm-hmm.
Which is quite nice and easy to use.
Yeah.
So you have basically the opposite approach from me. So I have a virtual machine through DigitalOcean, and I have my own Nginx and WordPress install that runs. That runs a WordPress blog that does that, and then I've also got a few other services that kind of run in the background in other ways. And I use just a variety of technologies to kind of keep it running and up in the air. And part of the reason why was I'm less familiar with the web front end of things, so I've really enjoyed the opportunity to kind of play around with it and figure it out and see how things actually run and work. But it's definitely been it's at times quite a nightmare to keep.
I haven't actually heard of DigitalOcean. Is that just a web hosting service?
Yeah, DigitalOcean. It's like a competitor to, Amazon or Rackspace or Azure or anything like that. And one of the things that they are unique for is that the deploying instance in 60 seconds, it's $5 a month for a half a gig of memory, a single core, and they're all solid state machines, so I have 30 gig solid state drive attached to it.
Wow.
Yeah, which is great for what I'm doing, right? My stuff is mostly text. It's a few a few media files or something like that, and I'm using a couple. I think all told with a bunch of other stuff that I'm running, it's like just three gig maybe of total space. So I've been really happy with DigitalOcean. They're not nearly as full service as Amazon is, but they're quite a bit cheaper, and so that's what I've been doing. And then of course I use Cloudflare as my CDN to keep the bad guys away and help alleviate my bandwidth costs and everything. But of course my site is not big enough to run into bandwidth issues. I think I get 100 gigabytes a month or terabyte a month or something like that. So
right,
yeah. But it's been fun. I've been learning a lot, figuring things out. WordPress still has some funky issues with Nginx. I probably should have stayed with Apache, but live and learn. So that's like, well, once, but now it's up and it's running fairly well. So there's still the time to first byte is still a lot longer than I would like it to be. So I need to dig into that root cause and see what's actually going on.
Have you tried the Memcached?
Yeah, I use Memcache, and I use an opcache. I use APC for the PHP code too. And I've actually thought about switching to HipHop to switch and try and run the Facebook's actual PHP like compiler, because yeah. That's what WordPress is. It's PHP.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not gone that level.
Can't you just if it's just a compiler? Can't you just compile WordPress? Just like get the compiler and just plug, run it through, plug and play.
Yeah, because it does a little bit of it. Doesn't it's a JIT, right? It's a just-in-time compiler.
Mm-hmm.
And so it you have to actually like run it. It basically runs like its own server, so you actually have to like run it within. You run WordPress like within it or something like that. So it's not too hard. I just haven't gotten the time to really mess with it. So.
Right. The one issue that I have been having with WordPress is that I've been wanting to include a number of interactive visuals made with D3.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of tough to find a way to get that into my WordPress blog post or a WordPress page. Because, I don't know, it's just hard to get WordPress to recognize what I'm doing. But I'm sure that there's a way. It's been done before, I'm sure. So I'm still working the kinks out in that.
Yeah. Another thing that you might... that's an interesting question. So I've been working on a project, on a little side project that'll hopefully go up at some point that will try and separate, so use Nginx as to run the HTML and that kind of stuff, and then passing the other queries back off to Node.js. So we'll see if that can come up and get running. But it's fun. It's a fun experiment project for me. And I actually run another website or two for some friends that sit that, they're also low traffic, so they just sit on my server and
mm-hmm.
and run. And so that's been fun to work with.
Cool.
Yeah. It's always an adventure, but it's adventure worth having, right? Yeah. I used to have a server stack in my parents' house of like old servers that I'd collected for my dad's company, and I think I had a Pentium 2 a dual processor, not cool dual core, dual processor Pentium 2 box
mm-hmm.
with like 500 megabytes of memory, you know, spread across 32 megabyte, you know, SDRAM sticks with like the full height SCSI drives that sounded like airplanes when they were taking off, right?
Yeah, so,
and then I had a beast on top of that, which was a dual processor Pentium 3, 1 gigahertz. I think I have 4 gig of RAM spread across like 500 megabyte sticks.
What year was this?
This was up until I think I was running this up until like 2009 or 2010.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, I would get the EOL machine, so I got the first the Pentium 2 box in 2005, maybe something like that. So, you know, I'd had it for different times and stages and stuff, but, you know, the big SCSI drives and all this. And it was a lot of fun, you know, playing. I ran an Active Directory domain and, like, all this ridiculous stuff. And it was, I had a little IPCOP, an old little computer that ran IPCOP that
mm-hmm.
would pass the Wi-Fi and everything. And it was a really complicated setup, but it was really fun to, you know, that's when I first started really digging into running servers and Linux and Windows and all this stuff. And It actually helped me out on some different projects and things. So
the first computer I ever got was it had a Celeron processor.
Yeah.
And it was 400 megahertz.
Wicked.
And it had a 4 gigabyte hard drive. 4 gigs, a massive 4 gigs.
This is a beast.
Yeah. And at the time it certainly was.
Yeah.
And maybe 128 megabytes of RAM. Yeah, it was like, you know what, I think even less than that, maybe 64 megabytes of RAM.
Did it run ME?
No, I think it was running Windows, it wasn't ME, what was the one before that?
98?
Yeah, that's what it was running.
Of course, you had a second edition or special edition, which had the USB support in it.
Of course.
Yeah, Windows 98 SE. I still have a disk of that. There was I don't know how it happened, but I think it was right before I went to college or right before I came to Seattle, I was cleaning out some closets and I found like 5 Windows 95 like discs with the original like certificate of authenticity and like mm-hmm. the codes and everything, and like 2 or 3 copies of Office 97, and it just is like, wow, it's just amazing how far we've come from then. And I found a SUSE Linux 5 install kit, which had like 5 or 6 CDs, right?
Yeah.
It was just like, and like at that point like nothing worked, it was just like a mess. And oh my gosh, KDE was not even, I mean, it wasn't even like a thing.
My dad still has some operating systems on floppy disk. And actually, do you remember those, the Z drives?
The zip drives?
Yeah.
Click a death.
Exactly. I used to love those, man. Because I used to get all these games, and my hard drive was too small on that computer, right? But I, you know, buy a game like Rainbow Six and want to install it somewhere, and I install the entire game on the zip drive.
No.
Yeah.
You did.
So it was like a game console.
Yeah.
I'd plug the cartridge in and I'd play the game and then take it out and put
wow.
it away. And I had a lot of games run this way. And it was a lot of fun.
Did you ever get the click of death?
Not really. I know that it has happened to people, but mm-hmm. it never happened to any of my zip drives.
I always wanted a zip drive. Actually, I wanted a jazz drive.
Mm-hmm.
One of those. Did you ever see the orb drives?
No.
Like literally, like these little orb like console things. And the one thing that I wanted was super floppies.
Super floppies?
Yeah, it was 3.5 inch floppy, but it used different layers and encoding or whatever, and you could get 120 megabytes on a floppy.
We should bring the floppy disk back.
Bring the floppy disk back?
Yeah. That's just so hipster. We should totally do it.
That would be super hipster. Exchanging mixtapes on floppy disks?
Yeah.
What do you get? I don't even remember. How much space is on a floppy? Is it in 3.44?
Yeah. Yeah.
3.14 or something?
Or is it 2.41?
Oh, my gosh. We need to look this up.
I know. This is important.
Yeah. That's... but it was like... It was never as much as you wanted it to be, right?
It was just barely...
Yeah.
Barely working.
Ubiquity, of course it... Of course it was.
I still have some of the big ones too, like the B drive, one of those huge floppy disks,
yeah,
like, which are even smaller in size, you know.
Yeah. Oh, the big like 5.5 inch.
2.88 megabytes. Is that what I see there?
Yeah, that was one of them. This is we should know this.
Wasn't it 1.44?
You know, it might have been 1.4. You're probably right. It was probably 1.44. Yeah, 1.44 megabytes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's nothing.
No. Oh, geez.
Yet people could write operating systems on that thing, man.
Yeah, but you had to have... I had a Windows... I think I had Windows 95. Or Windows 95. I had Windows 3.11, like for work groups or workstations, and I had Windows 95, and those were on like stacks of floppies. Look at this. Floppy disk, 1.44 megabytes, a pack of 10 for $8.45 on Amazon.
People still buy them, it looks like.
I mean, you have lots of old computers that still do them. You have data that needs to be backed up, and so you need to be able to transfer it if the drives die and stuff like that. It's just like...
That's probably a good niche to be in.
Yeah.
To be a floppy disk salesman.
Yeah. That, you have a small, but dwindling, but still there clientele, so...
Well, we can call it microstorage.
Microstorage.
A whole new niche, yeah. Instead of having, you know, with the cloud being this... de facto standard now.
Yeah.
You want to just store just enough.
And just enough.
And nothing more.
Interesting.
Well, why hold that extra space? You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. Have you seen Facebook is using Blu-ray discs to do their cold storage?
No.
It's like the evolution of tape.
I have not seen this.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. So they have like 10,000 discs or something.
But once you... Wait, you can't edit the storage because once you burn it on the disk...
They are rewritable. You can get rewritable floppies, but... Or not rewritable
floppies. Is it
rewritable Blu-rays.
Like,
what?
Can you rewrite them fast enough and all at the same time?
A lot of it you don't need to rewrite. You just...
Is it distributed? It's just one...
Yeah. They have the error correction and everything that runs in it. They have a presentation that I could try and link to. They did it at the Open Compute, but basically it's like replacing tape drives.
Crazy.
Yeah,
crazy.
The things that people... Everything old is new again, right?
Yep. It goes in a big circle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that note, I think it's time for us to be done for the week.
Yep, we're out of time.
That's right. Again, thank you guys for listening. You can find us on Twitter, at Nick Robinson and at Nikhil Gopal.
That's right.
And we'll see you guys next week.
Yep, and please subscribe to our iTunes feed. Our plan is to post a new episode every Wednesday.
Yep.
So stay tuned, you guys. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Tell your friends. Bye.